Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections here in the MSU libraries, and I'd like to welcome you to another evening with the Michigan Writers Series, and also my congratulations to you for coming out on such a snowy evening. This is, I think, almost our, we began in 1999 with the Michigan Writers Series. And on that first event, there was an ice storm, but since then we've had pretty good weather, and I think this has been the worst evening so far of all of it. So as I said, I applaud you for coming out on such a snowy, cold Michigan winter evening. Our guest tonight is Ilana Bloomberg, but before I introduce her to you, I just want to go over how the Michigan Writers Series works. Our guests will read for about 45 minutes. Afterwards, there'll be some time for questions from the audience, if there are any, and then we will wrap it up. One of the nice things about the Michigan Writers Series is that we not only highlight our wonderful writers in Michigan, but that also we record all the readings, and we then digitize them, and we put them out on the World Wide Web, so to speak, so that literally the whole world will be able to hear the reading tonight. So you're part of a worldwide audience, or eventually will be one, but you get to hear it live, so you're particularly fortunate. As I said, our guest tonight is Ilana Bloomberg. Professor Bloomberg is an assistant professor in James Madison College here at Michigan State University. She specializes in 19th century literature and culture, history of the novel, women in the novel, Holocaust literature, and ethnic identity in literature. She is a prize-winning author and has earned advanced degrees in both English and creative writing. Her most recent book, Houses of Study, A Jewish Woman Among Books, has been nominated for the Sami Rohr Prize in Jewish Literature. That book has been noted by some critics and others as saying, "In this book, Bloomberg traces her own path from a childhood immersed in Hebrew and classical Judaic texts, as well as Anglo-American novels and biographies, to a womanhood where the two literatures suddenly represent mutually exclusive possibilities for life. Set in Houses of Study, from a Jewish grammar school and high school to a Jerusalem yeshiva for women to a secular American university, her memoir asks, in an intimate and poignant manner, what happens when the traditional Jewish idea of learning asserts itself in a body that is female, a body directed by that same tradition towards a life of modesty, early marriage, and motherhood." Will you please join me in welcoming Ilana Bloomberg?
Thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to be here in the actual place as well as the virtual place on the web. And I was thinking that it's really an honor to be asked to speak at a library, because libraries are among my favorite places. And this book is very much about libraries, and so there's something very fitting in giving a reading in a university library. I thought I would tell you a little bit about the book and then get a chance to read from it. This book details two educations, really, what it was like to grow up learning from Jewish texts and in Jewish institutions, and what it was like to grow up reading novels, reading biographies, short stories, reading in English, and learning America, in a word, learning what it was to be a girl in the 20th century, and now, of course, the 21st century, who was trying to find a way toward her future. And I think one of the things that marked my sense of future was a conviction that I was going to have two sets of books in my life. And the cover of my book, I think, illustrates this quite nicely. I was going to have books that came from an ancient tradition of texts, books in Hebrew, books in Aramaic, and I was going to have books that were far more modern. And they may not sound modern to you when I say 19th century, but that's pretty modern. And as I got older, it started to seem more complex, less simple to have both those kinds of books, because they had different messages. And the messages were at times mutually exclusive. The old books, the Hebrew books, the Aramaic books, were all about keeping alive a tradition. They were about continuity. They were about community. And the newer books, I would say, had more impulse toward independence, more impulse toward individuality, toward finding yourself, a phrase we use today. And I wasn't quite clear how I was going to be able to bring those traditions together, what it would mean to break out, to find my own path, but at the same time to adhere to a communal life, structures that were ancient in their origins. I thought what I'd do tonight, because it's never easy to summarize a book in a quick reading, I thought what I'd do tonight, though, is evoke for you two different libraries that were very, very important to me, because I think they say a great deal about the challenges, not just about bringing together two paths of life, but also about being female, especially at this particular moment in history. So I thought I would begin by describing a library that held out a great deal of promise to me when I was 18. I went throughout my life to Jewish schools. So I always had a double education. I always had, you know, your ordinary math and English and social studies, but that was always joined with studies in Bible, studies in Jewish law, Jewish philosophy, Jewish legends, Jewish history. And when I was 18 and I'd graduated from an Orthodox Jewish high school, it was very common practice for the graduates of the high school to spend a year studying in Israel. And we would be studying there only Jewish texts, and it was very, very intensive study, really from morning to night. But it was a fairly new thing for women to be doing this. It wasn't new for women to be learning, but it was new for women to see themselves as people who could devote themselves exclusively to study. That had largely been a male province. And so when I got to Israel in 1988, and I was part of this new program that was going to teach Talmud, the codes of rabbinic law and lore, to women, I found that our library was actually a kitchen. And this was kind of remarkable to me because, of course, that seemed so stereotypical, that where you would teach girls would be in a kitchen. And the kitchen was not even converted. You know, it wasn't even renovated. It wasn't even masquerading as something else. It was really just a kitchen with a sink and a refrigerator and then some books. But this bespoke some of the problems of being a young woman trying to get a very rigorous Jewish education. So I'm going to read to you a little bit about that house of study. The title of my book, Houses of Study, refers to the places where I was educated, but it's also a literal translation from the Hebrew, which is Beit Midrash, which means a house of study or a house of seeking. So I'm going to describe the Beit Midrash, the house of study, where I tried to begin learning as an adult woman. Okay. Our nights were long. We would pass them staring at the pictures of food or writing letters home, waiting at the end of the line for the phone, sitting on each other's beds talking. We were supposed to be studying in the Beit Midrash, the house of study. Where was the house of study? One floor down from our apartment, 10 quick steps to the place that was supposed to be sacred, separate, different. An apartment just like the one in which we lived, the house of study had a bathroom, a kitchen, and 3 bedrooms. It seemed makeshift. Like a tent in the wilderness, our Beit Midrash seemed a substitute for the real thing, a meager offering. It was a kitchen posing as a house of study, its disguise as convincing as an evil witch offering a rosy apple. And yet, this library, this small gleaming library, was still a promise to me. 2 narrow walls were lined with shelves of books, books with brown spines, black spines, navy, maroon, gray spines with gold letters printed on them in Hebrew. The message was clear. These are words of value. If you own these books, they will make you wealthy. Heavy books, thick books, books with tiny print, spidery black letters, dense paragraphs, endless pages, dictionaries, codes of law, the Bible, the Talmud, how to prepare food on the Sabbath books, how to go to the mikvah books, how to clean the house for Passover books, histories, philosophies, fables and legends, biographies, letters, responsa, commentaries, commentaries on commentaries, commentaries on commentaries on commentaries, prayer books. I wanted to know them all, to sweep them off the shelves, pile them into my arms until I was hugging them all to me and take them back to my room. Where do I start? I thought. Who wrote these books and who has read them? What will I write and what will I read? And yet, I had no answers to these questions. It had been late August when my friends and I had entered the Beit Midrash for the first time. We were greeted by silence and stagnant air. We did not tiptoe in timidly. We were not awed by the presence of longtime students too absorbed in their learning to see or hear us enter. And here I'm talking about how new it was for young women to be doing this. If young men had been doing this, there would have been masses of people to join when they entered the Beit Midrash, and yet our Beit Midrash was truly empty, echoes, vacant. No hands transferred the sacred books into ours. Bewildered, we picked them out of the bookshelves randomly, wondering who might have studied them before us. We looked around for clues in the ceiling, the floor, the used tables, looked for a message, however cryptic, from the women who had preceded us, who had solved the mysteries we faced in the room wiped clean of all history. Was there any precedent for what I was about to do? Had any woman before me devoted time solely to studying Torah? Questions rose in the silent air. How do you do this? How do you spend a year or your life learning? When do you wake up? When do you go to sleep? How do you pray? How much time do you spend studying Talmud and how much time the Bible? What do you wear? What language do you speak? What do you discuss over meals? How do you spend your leisure time? Do you have any leisure time? Questions and questions and few answers. These were the sorts of questions that could not be answered in speech or in writing, but only in the seeing, in the sitting quietly behind someone you imagined had once been like you but was now otherwise. She had once walked into the Beit Midrash, cowed and unsure. But now when she enters, all distractions fade from her sight until she sees nothing but her table and her well-worn books and heads directly toward them. The knowing of a woman who lived in the thicket of voices, who had no time for food or sleep, who drank the water of Torah with great thirst and walked endless distances to sit before the wisest scholars. Where were these women? Where were they? Once I realized that they were missing, I began to hunt for them. I found them scattered in different places, in homes with many children, each one demanding their mother, in the market, hurriedly shopping for vegetables and ragalach, at jobs making a living, in university, in elementary schools or high schools, studying privately at their dining room tables with their own children, invited to guest lecture to women like me. Many of these women taught and many learned, but they were not in yeshiva. They laughed at the idea. Yeshiva means to sit. They had stopped sitting long ago. I want to move now to a different library, and this library is the one at Columbia University, which has much more in common with this library, I would say, than this MSU library, than the unrenovated kitchen in Jerusalem. I went to Columbia University in the early 1990s, and it was a very heated moment on campus in the sense that there were great debates over what should be taught in the university. We call these today the culture wars. What should be on a syllabus? Should women be represented differently on a syllabus? Should African-American authors be represented differently? Are we looking for the best in Western civilization and Western culture, or do we want something more representative? What are our standards for what is best? All these questions were very powerful ones at that time. And one of the most extraordinary things that I had ever seen when I got to Columbia was the library. It was this massive, enormous, scary-looking building. I didn't even make it in there for a year because it was so intimidating. But what was very, very striking when I began school there was that across the top of that library were engraved names of the great thinkers of the Western tradition. So, you know, Plato, Aristotle, Sophocles, philosophers, writers. And someone anonymous, had climbed to the top of the building and hung a massive banner across those names that provided what we would call a female canon, so the female alternatives to those male names. And it was very beautifully done. Didn't look like someone had just kind of scribbled it out. I mean, it was really a challenge to that other set of inscribed names. And that was what greeted me when I started school there. And I started to get the sense that there was a conflict, that there was something that I needed to learn about. What was this challenge that was being posed by these women in history, and these actual women on the Columbia campus to the male tradition? So that's what I want to read about now. And I want to read about what it was like to encounter that library and that banner at the same time as I was trying to take with me ideas from very traditional Jewish sources and to continue to study Jewish texts and traditional Jewish texts, meaning ancient ones. A banner was hanging on Butler Library, the massive regal home of Columbia University's books, the year I began my college studies. "Sappho," red letters cried across the beautiful wide white banner. "Aphra Behn, Mary Wollstonecraft, Jane Austen, Emily Dickinson, Virginia Woolf." From photographs, I knew that the library was engraved with other names: Homer, Herodotus, Sophocles, Plato, Aristotle. Yet in my first year at Barnard, which is the women's college associated with Columbia, the angels guarding passage were these untraditional ones. Clearly, they had guarded the passage of the fearless student who had crept undiscovered to the top of the building late at night and hung her flag. I learned all those female names in my English classes that year. I saw the banner on my way to class, but also on my way to pray and learn to study the classical texts of my tradition. In cool, damp morning, I crossed Broadway and walked alone down the silent paths of campus. The sleep of students weighted and softened the ground upon which I walked. It was like walking on pillows in dream and sleep. Yet when I arrived at Earle Hall, other students were awake too, facing day like the miniature adults of the early American paintings I learned about in class, paintings of children before the category had been invented. Our collective destination was the Beit Midrash, the Hall of Religious Study. There, the world of the university faded. The small library of holy texts superseded the stacks of Butler Library. Two tables, a bunch of chairs, two windows, some heat in the winter, a fan in the summer, two narrow bookcases of volumes contributed by the students themselves, left as a legacy for those who would follow. Thus was a small meeting room transformed into a permanent house of study. In an unusual dispensation, the room did not have to be shared with any other university group because we had explained to the officials that there could be no set hours in which we would agree as a community to abandon the Beit Midrash. "And you shall speak these words night and day." There was no rest to Torah study. The Beit Midrash was home to women and men, so this was kind of an extracurricular space, basically a place that we had dedicated to this pursuit but was part of the university architecture. The Beit Midrash was home to women and men, yet the content of our study was generally different. With the exception of my friends, nicknamed the Bravender's Girls after the yeshiva where we had studied in Israel, most women did not study Talmud, but Bible or Jewish law or even philosophy. Most men studied the Talmud. So the Talmud is the set of, it's a compendium of Jewish law that is enormous, volumes and volumes and volumes. We're talking about a text that was compiled in about the 5th century CE. And historically, that was a text that men have studied, and only quite recently has it become a text that women study. Always individual women here and there, special women, studied it. But now it's much more common to see groups of girls learning it, studying it. Even today, though, it's not common. It's more common. Carrying the large, manly volumes of Talmud, the Bravender's girls were a colony of discovered Yentls. From our first day in Jerusalem, we had learned the value of a good defense. Studying in what was then the only women's institute that focused its energies upon Talmud, a text historically closed to women, we became experts in the arguments for teaching women the oral Torah. The butt of the university Purim spiels, the Bravender's girls were bright Ivy League-bound girls. So we became really quite a caricature of ourselves. We could learn a page of Talmud as well as any guy, and we were not content to learn among ourselves alone. We wanted men as our study partners. The men we were looking for would be looking for us, too. A wife they could learn with and talk to, not relegate to the kitchen and bedroom to bake challah and bear children. We would graduate summa, pursue true careers, meet without fail to study Talmud, not Bible, pray each day in the correct hour. We would also raise children, prepare the meals in house for the Sabbath each week, and chair social action committees for our synagogues. The fact that not one of us knew a single older woman who embodied this ideal of achievement did not deter us. The difficult contradictions of being religious suffragettes found expression in our dress as well as in our minds. Unlike the skirts, girls who had attended traditional seminary and covered their knees and elbows with loose clothing, we coveted other things. Yet unlike the girls who had left a lifetime of Jewish schooling with the eager embrace of new college freedoms, miniskirts, tight t-shirts, shorts, flip-flops, we wanted respectability, to respect and be respected. And I'm going to describe now some of the challenges in figuring out what to wear. And this may seem rather trivial, you know, who has to think about what to wear? But the bottom line is that we identify ourselves very fundamentally. We announce ourselves in our dress. And this is never more true than in a religious community where the things that you wear, modesty, those kinds of codes, are so recognizable to insiders. And so figuring out what to wear and how to dress oneself became a way of thinking about what community I belong to and my friends and I belong to. So I guess I want to encourage you to think that, in fact, clothing is not in the least bit just material or trivial, but in fact, very much announcing of identity. We were as resourceful with, and I should also just explain to those of you who may be unfamiliar, that the code of modesty would indicate that girls wore skirts, long sleeves, so something like a mini skirt would really be like jumping off the edge of a cliff. We were as resourceful within a limited closet as our foremothers had been in their constrained kitchens. From years of dressing experience, we had our equivalents for jeans and sweatpants. We had the skirts that bordered on sex and the skirts that were simply comfortable and pleasant to look at. The long, flowy skirts, the short, fitted skirts, the jean skirt with tights and loafers, the jean skirt with keds and short socks, the jumper, the casual dress. Still, for all this acquired skill, the archetypal Bravender's girl was the girl with the Talmud, but in pants. Shock. Or even more often, debating the subject of wearing pants. It was our invariable conversation. Trained as fervid students, we naturally gravitated toward the insoluble puzzle, the one that could regenerate itself ceaselessly, daily, yearly. We knew better than any advertiser, any designer, the messages of clothing. The company we called for, the lives left behind, chosen, celebrated by fabric, cut, weave, width. Supposing we would say that we found the men who could tolerate, nay, appreciate the new women we were, what would happen beyond marriage? The problem of the skirt yielded immediately to the even more personal problem of the head, the hair. Would we, when we got married, cover our hair in modesty as the more traditional Orthodox women did? So that is typical for more traditional Orthodox women to either wear a hat all the time or to cover their hair with a wig or some other form that retains their modesty so that only at home would they expose their hair in front of men that they're not married to. We rehearsed these debates often and in prolonged form because they were our way of asking whether our souls belong to Orthodoxy or modernity. In talking about skirts and pants and wigs and hats, we were trying out possible futures. Which romance would we construct for ourselves, dress for, try to find? The marriage in which one covered one's hair would be the marriage of quiet, private passion, a passion no one else could know but only guess at. The inside of one's home would be the only inside. Every other place, every other man would be a place and person who were not home and never could be. If you covered your hair, you were a woman before you were a person. You asked people to look at you and think of your being a woman, think of your sex and how they could not have it. You were untouchable and unknowable. You held yourself upright, never forgot yourself. That was what covering your hair was meant to ensure. Memory of self, memory of what is not self. Not covering your hair was the American thing to do. The free magazine ad look of woman as a person traveling in the world, usually alone, though whatever intimacy she found would be as unabashed and natural as her walk and talk. Not covering your hair was the romance of knowability. You might know others and they might know you. No one would hesitate before talking to you or approaching you. You were friendly, available, like other people. You belong to no one but the world. Your husband was not destined for you, but chosen. Your children were not given to you as a blessing, as a grace, but came naturally, just as all your words to them did, just as your decisions did. No one watches you, and you do not watch yourself. The fantasy of being the woman with her head covered posed for me a great dilemma. Even as I could imagine such a marriage, could imagine such a husband and such a life, I knew that I was redeeming bad merchandise. I knew I should not want to cover my hair. I knew I should be on the side of the women who fought against it. But when I saw my future, I could not help but see hats and scarves. Like a little girl imagining herself grown up, yet unable to imagine the transformed face and body that would be hers, I did not imagine myself dressed as a wife and mother, because it would not be I. It would be some woman who had given birth to the me that lived now, a woman older and wiser. How could I argue with her? But these were the secret thoughts. My friends and I spoke of justice, not romance, large social forms, not the strange, mutating shapes of desire. And in the face of the injustices we confronted, we were right to avoid the confusions of desire. First, there was our thorough exclusion from leadership in all prayer services, our uncounted presence absorbing the echo of the voice that traveled toward us in synagogue, blessing God for having made him a man and not a woman. There were visits home to my family's synagogue in Chicago, where I heard all my male friends call to the Torah. I watched them return to their seats, greeted with warm handshakes by all the men they passed. Then two men turned to reprimand me because I had, from my seat at the back of the sanctuary, reached over the mechitza, the barrier separating men and women in prayer, for a volume of the commentary I was studying. There were no books on the women's side, I explained. And then there was the ongoing, still passionate debate among Columbia students over women's study of Talmud. For example, what to make of the rabbinic statement in the Mishnah that the father who teaches his daughter the oral Torah has taught her nothing but licentiousness. Across the world from our mentors in Israel, my friends and I invoked their ideas. We reminded ourselves of the passionate professor of Jewish thought, head covered, who had turned to the Talmud to support her claim that it was the practice of people known to be pious that ultimately would become validated and confirmed as halakha, Jewish law. If you want to know the law, go look in the market. This was what the rabbis of the Talmud had said in a period of devotion to the law. People devoted to the law did not destroy it. If they altered it slightly or even dramatically, they altered it for the sake of survival or the greatness of God's name. In practical terms, this meant to me that if we, the girls, were beyond reproach when it came to prayer and study, generosity of behavior and strictness of law, then our other choices, our more modern choices, would gain acceptance too. If we were blameless, if we were known to be acting for the sake of heaven, l'shem shamayim, then the halakha, the law, would have to follow in our footsteps. We took this idea to live by, yet it was not easy. How long would it take? What would we have to sacrifice to prove that we were acting l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven? All our personal observance of daily prayer and regular study did not suffice. We were trying to convince people that we weren't radicals overturning things just for the sake of, the kind of feminism that people said is a bad word, just wanting a kind of pure independence, totally distinct from tradition. This was a religious purpose that we had. We wanted to be able to participate in these rituals. We wanted to be able to study out of something that you might call love of God or fear of God. It wasn't distinct from the religion itself, and yet it was very hard to convey that. All our personal observance of daily prayer and regular study did not suffice. The dictated sexual abstinence before marriage did not suffice. Our visible pain at the suggestion that took the Columbia community by storm, that women and men should not only pray separately, but have separate hours to learn in the Beit Midrash, did not stand for us. Sorrow at the backward step of segregating men and women in the one space that should have existed above law, learning, the utopian instant in which men and women might for once lose the sex and the difference that tinged all other things and put our minds to work in the service of something that was neither one of us but divine, a text before whom we stood as equals, that sorrow did not prove us either. I could not understand how the pain of these arguments and our embattled positions did not sufficiently, even amply, prove that we were acting for the sake of heaven, that we were not simply serving our own desires and passions. Why could the powerful rabbis and legislators of our communities not see that if we were not well-intentioned, we would have dropped out long ago with the first frustration, the first affront to dignity, instead of redoubling our efforts? Wasn't it easier not to wake up every morning at 6 to meet the cold air to go to pray in the quorum of 10 men that constituted a public when the reward for our piety was to be told face-to-face by the more sympathetic rabbinic authorities that even 10,000 women would never constitute a public? At this time, I believed with firm and whole faith that as harsh and unkind as these rabbis were, God was sympathetic. I spoke to the God in whom I believed in a kind of prayer that had come to resemble my communal life. Pleasure and pain were made of the same substance. As the waves of the Red Sea had been blown by wind to solidity, then stood quivering, masquerading as walls, pleasure was unstable, could collapse at any moment into the despair that flowed over the heads of the Egyptians. Or perhaps the flow of water was the pleasure and the walls the pain. I could not tell. Yet even when one prays intensely, one lives in space, always particular space. Each morning, as I would walk to prayer services along the silent paths of the deserted early morning campus, I nodded to that banner, to Sappho, Aphra Behn, Mary Wollstonecraft, Jane Austen, George Eliot, Emily Dickinson, Virginia Woolf. I walked by the banner on my way to pray and learn, and then I walked by it later on my way to class. I went to class in skirts, as I had for 4 years in Orthodox high school and 1 year in yeshiva. Day after day, I had done what I could with a skirt that covered my knees. But unlike hats and scarves, there were no fantasies associated with skirt wearing. I did not have to teach myself its oppressive nature because I felt it. The abundance of material depressed me. Length, folds, and pleats depressed me. The shoes I liked could not really be worn with skirts, so my feet felt as covered and shaped as my legs. Shoes and clothes take you places, and my shoes and clothes made it difficult, nearly impossible, to go to the neighborhood bar with my roommate, or to the small hip cafe, or to any place that did not recognize and understand me. Like a dowdy twin always turning up to show others how paltry you could have been, my clothing swamped me. For 7 years, I had gone to school in skirts until one day I went to my junior English seminar in pants. I did not even make a real decision. After all my tortured study of the laws of modesty and the endless conversation with friends about whether a pious man would see beyond or even better understand such clothes, after all that worry over whether we would be loved and whether we were good, one day I got up and put on an old pair of pants. I had thought that what I wanted was to wear sensible, unremarkable, modest pants. When I had talked about it with friends, that was what I had said. That was how I had known that these intentions, too, rebellious as they seemed, were for the sake of heaven. They stemmed from innocent wants and needs, an interest in variety, my enthusiasm to run or climb. In high school for gym, we had worn skirts over sweatpants as we played baseball with a plastic bat in the parking lot around stationary cars. This is true. The boys had worn shorts and played basketball in the gym. My desire now did not even come near shorts. They seemed to me the same as nakedness. I thought only of pants, not even jeans, which I knew bespoke too rugged a self, too natural, not conscious enough of myself as separate from others. Conceivably, as my friends and I argued, one could wear modest pants and still cover one's hair, still be respectable. But who wore jeans and covered her hair? Yet when I found myself in the store later that week in front of the mirror, 1991, and here I'm sad because I know that the students here won't get this reference at all because it's too old now, but in 1991, the jeans that I found were Guess jeans, and these were the cool jeans, the sexy jeans. So I don't know if that term, if that brand is even still around, but this was a big decision. As if uncovering my own secret that I had known all along, there was no such thing as unremarkable pants, that pants meant remarkable. I had skipped all the intermediate stages, culottes, baggy pants, overalls, sweatpants, slacks, and gone to precisely the sort of pants that the books on modesty were really talking about, the pants they did not describe in fear, but the pants they conjured. But I did not allow the jeans to signify as everyone had believed they would. I abandoned nothing. In my jeans now, I prayed, I learned, I said blessings, I ate kosher food, I honored the Sabbath, I continued to debate the rights of women in the heart of our Jewish community, and I went to class. Virginia Woolf had written the following 70 years earlier. Who shall measure the heat and violence of the poet's heart when caught and tangled in a woman's body? When I had finished reading her slim volume, A Room of One's Own, from the 1920s, a single phrase rung in my ears, torn asunder. In her short essay, Woolf had repeated this phrase of violent division at least four times. When I had thought about it in my memory, I'd remembered it on every page. In A Room of One's Own, The Awakening, The House of Mirth, Middlemarch, Jane Eyre, Vindication, in the voices of the feminist scholars who had written about them, and in the voices of my professors at Barnard, I found a sympathetic community. women who knew what it was to be judged by sex and shut out of libraries, but they had crossed over, and I had not yet. My writing professor said, "Write about the female body." And though I was wearing my jeans, all I could think was, if I ever publish anything, will my hair in the jacket photo be real or a wig? And I'd like to end with a very short section, again, about a library, which still seems so fitting to me being here. I taught at the University of Michigan before I came to teach here at Michigan State, and discovered that lots of students never made it to the library because you can Google everything now. And this kind of appalled me in a sort of righteous sense, but also it seemed like really quite a loss. And I remembered that sense at Columbia of just being so overwhelmed and intimidated by the enormousness of that library and feeling that maybe I didn't deserve to go in there because it was so scholarly and grown up. And so it seemed very important to me to take students to the library rather than just hope that they would get there themselves. So I want to read just briefly about what that meant to me and what it means to me here as well. A few weeks ago, I took my English students for a tour of the university library. An excellent librarian led us through. I like to do this with first-year students because many of them find Google sufficient for their research and the library shelves are too often left undisturbed. Then, too, university libraries can intimidate the uninitiated. It would be nearly impossible for me to convey to my students what the university library meant to me when I was a college student. For starters, I was astounded and moved that there were weeks at a time at the end of each semester that it never closed. I don't know if that's the case here. Is it 24 hours? Okay. Its doors simply never closed. They never locked against students or the night. In those years, when I was looking for open libraries, looking for what the Victorians called sympathy or fellow feeling, my ability to enter the library at any time of day or night granted it a sanctity that no other university building could have possessed. I know that the history of women in the American Academy has been and remains troubled, and that Jews, too, once found doors closed against them in these universities. But by the 1990s, the American University offered an Orthodox Jewish woman something she could not get anywhere else: knowledge, the capacity to teach it at the highest levels, and a degree that did not differentiate on the basis of sex. When I got married, I received a card from a friend of many years, a friend with whom I had gone to high school, who now also teaches in a university. Its address read, "Mr. and Mrs. Ori Weisberg," that's my husband's name, "in care of Dr. Ilana Blumberg." It is nice to be a Jewish woman with a degree of her own. Thank you. And I'm happy to take questions if anyone has any. Yes, yeah.
I'd like to ask you what neighborhood in Chicago you grew up in?
I grew up in Skokie. Uh-huh. Are you a Chicagoan?
I grew up there too.
Really?
Not in Skokie.
Uh-huh. Where are you from?
Well, I grew up in Albany Park, mm-hmm. which is you know where
that
is. It's very different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, things have changed somewhat in the Orthodox community that I grew up in. In some ways, it's moved to the right, and in some ways, it's moved to the left, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In some ways, in the middle?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the Highland Park scene.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that feels distinct to me from Skokie, because I think the conservative community is stronger there than the Orthodox. So, Kelly? No, no, she didn't. She is a Jewish educator. She's a teacher herself. But she also came of age in a time when certain customs were more relaxed in the United States. And so one of the things that has really changed is that many of the young women my age that I know do cover their hair, friends that I grew up with, and their mothers didn't. So there's been a shift to more traditional practice. So I didn't have a model for that kind of traditional appearance in my mother, but I certainly had a model for someone trying to, you know, both be in a traditional world and in a modern one. But the markers, the outside, the external markers kind of shifted in a way that made it, I think, harder for daughters to figure out what to do on the basis of their mothers. In the ultra-Orthodox world, where there's less attempt to reconcile with modernity, then I think there's much more continuity between the generations, much less of the pendulum swing. But in the community where people are kind of going back and forth between the larger American experience and a more interior Jewish world, I think there you do have these kind of shifts back and forth.
You know, you're almost two generations younger than I am. And at the time that I was growing up, the emphasis was to become American, whereas you...
I'm describing in some ways the opposite. You know,
the opposite.
Yeah, an instinct or an impulse to separate and to make sure to cleave to an ethnic or a religious definition. I mean, that was part of what was going on at Columbia, you know, the division into small groups, you know, so that there was a center for African-American students, there was a center for Jewish students, and the melting pot idea of America did not seem to be as captivating to the imagination in the 90s.
Well, it's all a center identity. And when I grew up, your identity absolutely was given. And then the other identity, what's a woman's.
Yes.
But, and you only mentioned the word equal once.
Mm-hmm.
See, but it's all about equality.
Yes, that's interesting that the word itself only comes up once, but yes, the book is all about that. Any other questions or comments? What do I teach here? I'm honored to have some students with me tonight. I teach first-year courses in humanities that focus on writing, clarity of expression, and on thinking carefully about the materials one reads, whatever those are. I also teach courses in Bible, in American Jewish literature, and I may wind up doing some teaching in my actual field of expertise, which is Victorian literature. That's kind of been out in the cold a bit recently, but that is actually the field that I trained in. At the University of Pennsylvania. Carly, you had a question?
I was just curious if the reaction just in the ultra-Orthodox for your book, I'm assuming that you will currently.
The truth is that there is a very big division in the American Jewish world between what is called modern Orthodox, which is, I guess, me, and ultra-Orthodox. There's not a lot of crossover. Children don't go to the same schools. People don't pray at the same synagogues. They don't shop at the same supermarkets. So there's quite a significant division. So I would say my experience has been that one ultra-Orthodox woman has written me after having read my book. But many more women that, let's say, are conservative or reform Jews, which is more liberal, more modern, let's say, than modern Orthodox, those women have read the book and have had interesting things to say. One ultra-Orthodox woman has read it, and I think that's reflective in part of the fact that the ultra-Orthodox stay within their own circle more. They look out of it less, and a book like this would be heretical. It is heretical. So the woman who wrote me, I was very conflicted about what to do about it. She wrote me and she said, I think you don't understand that you just need to make a choice. So, for instance, you know, your children don't grow up terribly confused. You're running the risk of your children being very confused about how to live their lives. You need to choose. You either are going to be really an observant Jew or you're going to be modern. And I felt very conflicted because I didn't know whether I should write back, what to write back. I didn't know if I should be angry, if I should be sympathetic. I really had no idea what this all meant. And I thought and I thought, and I did write back because I felt like, you know, she emails, so, you know, I mean, people, anyone can write you. So I wrote back and I said that I really wasn't, that in some ways the whole book is about not giving up on one thing or the other, that It's not a rejectionist book. I'm not saying, oh, look at that terrible religion that's so antiquated that doesn't allow women to do anything. And I'm also not willing to say, look at that terrible secular wisdom that gives people desires for all kinds of things that are complicated and that they might not be able to have or that they may not be able to get easily. And I can't give up one or the other. You know, it's also constitutional. I mean, what would I can't. I simply can't. But also, you know, I think that is a posture in the world, and I think it's possible to educate children in such a way that they don't feel like they have to either accept, you know, 100% what you give them, but they also don't have to throw it all away, which I fear would be the case if I came down really hard, you know, and said it's just this one thing. Then if my kid liked that thing, then great. But what if they didn't? Then there'd be nothing left. So, you know, that was my experience with the one reader I've had who's contacted me.
Well, you're right on track. You know, you were brought up a certain way, and I wouldn't say you don't seem confused, but you certainly were inquiring and conflicted, and you've made a very nice synthesis.
I've tried. It's been hard.
Yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it's not easy, and I think, you know, there were years that were extremely difficult, where it really didn't seem clear that it would be possible to reconcile.
Yeah.
And I don't think this book could have been finished until I'd come to a point where it seemed maybe more possible.
Well, we have children who, you know, have the same problems to face. Mm-hmm. And they've made their own sympathies, and there are different, four different kids in four different ways, but they're all valid.
Mm-hmm. I'm very grateful to everyone for coming out tonight, and it was a pleasure to talk with you and read. And thanks also to Peter Berg here at the library, who gave me the opportunity to read in a university library. So thank you.
Thank you very much.